Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here with Dr. Kay Whitehead, Assistant Professor of Communication and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African-American and African and African-American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland. Her latest book is Race Brave, New and Selected Works, and it's an incredible book of poetry that she has put out from her history of work, and of course written books like Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, which was amazing, Letters to My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. Kay, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be back. We haven't been on the air together
in
quite a long time. I'm excited about that.
I know. You've been coming in and sitting here at the mic. And
I almost sat in the chair today. Almost.
I'll switch places with you. So talk about this book you wrote, Race Brave. Give our listeners a sense of what this book is and why you wrote it.
Well, it's interesting because when I first started in the field many years ago, I started as a poet. I had come out of college at Lincoln University, and I joined the Beat Poet Move, where I was going back and forth between Washington, D.C. and New York, really trying to get my legs wet as a poet, writing and performing. We had just started doing kind of New Eurekan Poets, and I started winning awards. I had won the Langston Hughes David Diop Ethridge Knight Poetry Award. I won an award from the Gwendolyn Brooks Creative Writing Center by publishing my poetry. And then I went back to graduate school, and I got off the poetry path, and everything else has come as a result of that. But in the last year, when I've been dealing with the Baltimore uprising, my sons challenged me to start writing poetry again. Writing poetry about the event in real time. So to write a poem per day about what was happening. And the challenge was, if I didn't finish a poem by midnight, I had to destroy it and start again the next day. So that was the challenge. And that became the book Race Brave. And so Race Brave, New and Selected Works has poetry, diary excerpts, has family stories, all about this year that I've been dealing with of the Baltimore uprising and watching my sons kind of birth their own activism.
So why don't you read a selection from that for us?
I will. One of the first pieces that I wrote is called What Happens When the Lights Go Out. And now, like Ferguson, like New York, like South Carolina, Baltimore has become some type of place where some cops, white or black or brown, male or female, masquerade as judge, juror, executioner. Where we find ourselves with questions and no answers, in mourning but without tears, in jungles, concrete, no glass, in prisons, control, guarded, no bars, in hell, our sins judged by sinners, dripping blood from their teeth, tearing our hearts straight out of our chest. We must remember that only the wicked see black skin. As a sign of guilt. Mistake loaded guns for tasers, running as a sign of guilt. Wallets for loaded weapons see toy guns as real. They never hear our shouts for help as real. They can't believe that we can't breathe, that we want to be free, that we want to grow up. They can't accept that we belong here too. That it is our blood that runs thick with the same soil that we use to grow our organic food, our pain being used to feed a nation again. Our young brothers and sisters, now ageless and faceless, martyrs really, did not die, did not pass away. They are not lost. They were killed, murdered, shot, choked. They are not lost because we know exactly where they are.
Mm. So talk about how you wrote these pieces. I mean, what – because you – after – this is the week, of course, that we remember. This is the week that Fred Gray was arrested, tomorrow.
Yes.
And then he died in the hospital after being taken to police custody. And you were out in the community, in the streets during this whole time.
Yes, we had been following for a while. When Trayvon Martin was killed, it was kind of a realization for my husband and I. And I think that shifted my work significantly, where I had been so involved with the academy. But when Trayvon Martin died, I realized that I could not educate myself enough to keep my sons safe. I could not put them only in the right schools, have them play certain types of sports, spend all this money on them, because no matter where they are in America, there are black boys growing up in this, what we call this post-racial. We always say that with a question mark, America. So I decided to come out of the academy and to begin to do more community activism, to do more community work. And that's really when I got to know you, Mark, because my whole trajectory changed. I started doing op-eds, I started speaking in the community, and we were tracking every step of the way what was happening. And my boys began to keep a list on their walls. And every time another unarmed black person died, they added the name to their wall, and they would say, Mommy, what are we going to do now? When are we going to get involved? And I kept thinking maybe I could keep them from Ohio. I can keep them from New York. I can keep them from Florida. And then Freddie Gray in Baltimore, and I couldn't keep them from it anymore. And my sons made a decision at 15 and 13 now, at the time they were 14 and 12, they said, we're going to go out there. We want to go and we want to be actively involved to make our voices heard. And the challenge was for me to then go with them.
So how did that change you?
It moved me from being a spectator to being a participant. It shifted my work from what I call research to me-search. All of a sudden, 19th century black women didn't seem nearly as important and significant to me as making sure that I was helping to co-create a world in which my boys could grow up and be safe. So Letters to My Black Sons was birthed out of that work, and Race Brave is a direct result of it. Who am I now as a scholar, as an artist, as a black mommy activist? Everything shifted for me, because what I want to do now is I want to use every ounce of strength and energy that I have to sing this song that Black Lives Matter. And part of that is to make sure my boys have a world they can grow up in.
So this book is a compilation of things you've written in the past as well, or these are all new pieces?
I have a few older pieces in here. I went back through all of my archives, and I've been writing and keeping diaries since I was 12 years old. So I have a lot of material that I hope that, you know, when I someday lead this experiment called life, that somebody will burn my work, because I don't want to be the Emily Davis of 150 years from now, having someone kind of sift through what I've done all my life. But this work primarily is new work. And there are a few pieces that I've reworked from my childhood, a few pieces that I've reworked that won awards that I think people might be very interested to take a look at. If they like poetry, if they like stories, if they like figuring out how we're working to raise up our boys, if they like challenging themselves with thinking about what it means to be race brave. Do you have the courage to stand up and speak out? This book kind of talks about all of that.
So, is there an old piece you'd like to share with us that you've written?
Yes.
Something from the that's not of this moment, but that means a great deal to you?
Yes, I will find an older piece that I've been working with, because it's interesting. When I was thinking about putting everything into the book, my editor was challenging me, saying that all the pieces were just so sad. but the uprising was, I think, both a sad time, of course, but it was also a time when we begin to think about who we are as a nation, mm-hmm. and then even more specifically who we are as a city. A few years ago, when Bill Clinton was president, he launched a program called the AmeriCorps program, if you remember that. And part of that is he did Writers' Corps. And Writers' Corps didn't last very long, but what he did is he had this idea that if he could just set up writers and send them out all around the country, then we'll have peace if people are writing. And he chose 60 writers, 20 in D.C., 20 in New York, and 20 in San Francisco. I was one of the 20. And we were invited to the White House, and he gave us our charge to go out into correctional treatment facilities, into elementary schools, into high schools, community centers, and share poetry. This piece here, The Sound of My Blues, was written for the women at the D.C. Correctional Treatment Facility. They told me not to ever tell this story, not to repeat it, not to think about it, not to ever even act like I remember what was happening on those days when King got shot, when Kennedy got assassinated, when X simply got bumped off. Nobody wants to talk about how my spirit got destroyed every time my gun-toting, marijuana-smoking, fatigue-wearing revolutionary daddy used to beat my mother with the same intensity that sinful black folks pray on Sunday mornings and five times a day in rooms facing east. I wasn't supposed to hear, but I listened to the sounds of my daddy beating my mother's head up against the wall. She didn't have to take it, but she did. Said she never knew love could hurt so much. They told me to pretend I hadn't heard, but I listened every time he came home from the movement, pissed off at the man looking for a much easier target. My grandmother used to dry her tears and pat her hands, all the while teaching her how to stand tall and swallow hard, because when he hits you, it only means he loves you more. And anyway, black men face far too much resistance from the world to be completely responsible for their actions. My mama used to laugh between her tears every time she remembered the good old days of cheap wine and hamburger dinners and making out in the backseat of my granddaddy's pickup. I wasn't supposed to ask questions, but I did, and I wanted to know, what did this have to do with the fact that he used to beat her? Every time she wanted to run or she talked about freedom, he beat her. Sometimes with the talking into the phone, but most times he did it with his hands. So what does it mean, I wanted to know? Because to me, a black man beating a black woman conjures up images of half-picked cotton fields, secret slave freedom rituals, and babies being pulled from black breasts by white hands. Any man beating any woman made me think about Cassandra's daddy, who used to beat her in the basement with his frat pad on her pants down till she cried out to God for salvation. And that always stopped him, because her daddy was a preacher from 8 to 1 on Sundays and 6 to 7 on Wednesday evenings.
Dr. Kay Whitehead, this is her new book. We'll be right back to hear more of her poetry and talk about the uprising and where we are today. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I'm here with Dr. Kay Whitehead, who, of course, professor of Africana and African American Studies at Loyola University, noted author, and host here on the Mark Steiner Show often,
which I love.
Which we love.
One
doing
of my better day jobs.
I like that. We love it when you're sitting in here. And she's written this incredible new book called Race Brave, some short essays and poems that were inspired by what happened to Freddie Gray and the uprising afterwards and how it affected her life and her family. Kay was out in those streets every day. I remember when they shut down those buses, Kay Whitehead, along with Dr. Heber Brown, were out there making sure kids were safe who got stuck there because they shut down the transportation system. And she joins today with a book that was inspired by all of that called Race Brave.
So it's interesting because during that period when we were out there every day making the commitment with my sons to march for 10 days. And I kind of call that the time when I became a true black mommy activist. I used to say this term a lot when I first had the boys. I said, well, if I'm going to have children, because I was very surprised that someone had chosen me to be their mother anyway. But if I'm going to have children, then I'm going to be a black mommy activist. So I'm going to raise them where they're doing sit-in movements in the basement and they're doing walkouts during dinner time, because I had this notion that this activist spirit needed to be laid early with them. But I never knew then, very honestly, Mark, that one day they would have to call upon that. Like, I never knew what that would be like. I remember the day, you remember this as well, when my sons had taken out white T-shirts and were beginning to put their name and their phone number on these white T-shirts, because somebody had told them that if something happens to them, that the police had to identify their body. So they were thinking that, you know, they saw what happened in Ferguson. So they didn't know, and I didn't know, exactly what was going to eventually happen in Baltimore. I try to remind people that leading up to all the major events that happened, there were days of peaceful protest, days where we marched from City Hall, from Freddie Gray's neighborhood down the City Hall every single day. People got on the bandwagon when everything came to a head that day at Mondawmin Mall. But prior to that, we had been marching and standing. Prior to that, we had gone to Freddie Gray's wake. Prior to that, we had been in his community on that Saturday. There were things happening every day, the peaceful protests that the media did not want to cover.
So do you have a piece that you wrote that kind of speaks to that, that speaks to especially your boys and what they what it means to be a young black man in this world at this moment?
I do. It's called Black Mommy Activism Part 1. For 10 days without fail, you marched for Freddie Gray. You marched for justice. You marched and dreamed of a better world, in search of a better tomorrow, away from all of our yesterdays. You marched because you wanted to be free, having spent your life listening for the whispers of freedom. You thought you were on your way to freedom, and that the road went straight through East Baltimore, straight through Freddie Gray's block, straight through his home, straight through his life. And so you marched, never having marched before, never having struggled before, never having before. You marched and marched. You complained while marching. You cried out while marching. And then you found yourself while marching. I marched too, but I simply marched for you.
You know, when that's very powerful, the way you ended that. And I was thinking about your sons, who I've met, who are incredibly bright and lovely young men.
Thank you.
They really are. I mean, they always have their heads in a book. You know, they're, they're very serious and also very lovely young guys. And the idea that you see these two young, beautiful young men and you have to worry about whether or not they will survive through a day just because any officer can look at them or anybody can look at them and think of them as something other than they are.
And it's very difficult. I know that I sometimes think about my sons and the life that we're creating for them and what we're trying to do. We chose Baltimore as our home. We are originally from New York, and we moved to Baltimore for my husband to launch a feeding ministry for the homeless. So we've been here, you know, 12 or 13 years, and Baltimore is a kind of city. 12 or 13 years, we're still outsiders, right? And so we're still, we have not completely been let inside the gate yet. But watching them kind of navigate, and this year in particular, my sons are attending two different schools. So I have one son who's attending an independent school and one son who's attending a public school. And one morning as I was driving my youngest son, who was attending public schools, to school, he was practicing what they were doing in terms of they were planning for what would happen if a gunman came into the building.
Wow.
And they were doing this practice training. And so listening to him kind of go through the steps out loud encouraged me to write this piece. And I pulled over because I was so overwhelmed. It's called Morning Drive Time. My youngest son speaking softly, hear the shots, cut off the lights, stack the books, hit the floor, go up against the wall, close my eyes, pray. I glance over at him for a moment and open one eye, look for her. If she's next to you, grab her hand, tell her it's going to be okay. I open my mouth to speak, but don't try to be a hero. Get out of here alive. You're a whitehead. You're a survivor. Then I close it. God bless you, Amir. They will know your name. You will not be a hashtag. Mommy won't make a T-shirt with your face on it. I pull over to pray, to collect myself, to just sit in solidarity with him. I am more than a hashtag. I'm more than a movement. I'm more than that. They can't kill us all. They can't kill us all. They can't kill us all. He leans his head back and closes his eyes. They can't kill us all. I begin to dry because there's nothing to say. My reality once again meets me face to face. As I'm raising two black boys in America and I send them out every day without bulletproof vests or hand grenades. They go out without shields or swords. They are unarmed but have been baptized in my prayers and my silent hope of a safer world. I send them out even though I'm afraid, even though I can barely speak, even though I have to bite my fist to keep from screaming out, even though I have to bite my tongue to keep from yelling out, even though I spend every moment of every day laying down my burdens while they are at school, and even though I know that I alone cannot save them, I send them out anyway. They can't kill us all. They can't kill us all. And yet and yet and yet, as a black mother in America, I send them out every day anyway.
And I think that speaks to a lot of people and their feelings about where we are in this culture and the society right now. I mean, and it's just been exacerbated by all the craziness we see around us.
Well, this is also a crazy month. I was reading an article in the New York Times yesterday talking about the month of April being this kind of trigger month, and it made me think again about morning drive time with all the things that have happened in April, from Columbine to Hitler's birthday to the end of the Civil War. Like April, you know, Virginia Tech, April is a trigger month. So on top of all the things we're thinking about in the streets this month, right, with the uprising, we're thinking about what's happening with the safety in the schools. These are
all
real things that mothers of any race or ethnicity have to deal with. How do we keep our children safe in a world where there's dangers both seen and unseen all around them?
This is also the month that we know that Martin Luther King's assassination.
Yes, that's coming up.
It is the month that the rebellion took place because of that. It is also the month that in April of 1861 that Union troops were attacked in the city of Baltimore and free black people were attacked in the streets of Baltimore by mobs who opposed Lincoln and even the notion of any kind of freedom in this country.
Yeah.
So this is a powerful month.
This is a powerful month. And so this research is saying, what is it about April that triggers these things? Is it because of anniversaries or because of concern?
So, folks, think about that. We'll be right back as we talk about how important the station is and the work we try to do here with you. Dr. K.
I am here.
Dr. K and Mr. Mark.
I am here. This is an amazing show. I'm getting, people are coming in on Twitter.
I don't like Mr. Mark. I take that back.
Mr. Mark. Now, I always call you Pastor Mark.
Pastor Mark.
That's how I say it.
Pastor Mark.
I say Pastor Reverend Run Mark.
410. Oh, no. We're talking about your book right now.
We're talking about my book right now. But people can still call.
They can. While we're talking about the book, 410-319-8888. And we're talking about Kay Whitehead's book. She's written now, this is your fifth book?
This is my fourth book, actually.
Yeah.
I know. It's
prolific
very interesting.
Young woman.
Well, it's interesting because I keep feeling like I have so much I want to say. But it's making me think a lot because now that my one-year sabbatical is almost over, which I've loved, I have to think about where my work is going. And I really think that I'm going to spend a lot more time doing this research. I want to research and study more about black boys making their way through America and what that means.
So what would you like to read on from the book that might have to do with whatever it has to do with?
Okay. Well, it's interesting because I'm sure everybody's familiar with Urbanite. Everybody knows Urbanite. Urbanite the magazine.
Right.
Well, they came back in and did one special issue.
Right.
And that issue was all about the Baltimore uprising. And they contacted me and asked me to submit a piece to Urbanite. And I'm telling you, that was what a glorious day that was for me because I had always enjoyed reading Urbanite. And to have them approach me to submit a piece just said something to me. It spoke to the work that I was doing. That piece I submitted was called Songs in a Key Called Baltimore. So I'll read a little bit of it.
Oh, yeah, please do. Yeah.
and see how it goes. I would like to write a song about peace, about reconciliation, about a city coming back together and working for the common good. I would like to write that Black Lives Matter and point to the ways in which this simple concept, screamed and shouted, cried over and prayed about, has transformed the city and altered our space. I would like to teach my boys about peace in a city while raising them in a city where peace has never been the norm. Peace is not taught on the playground. Peace is not practiced in the school. Peace is not modeled on the street corner. I try and hide my frustration because in the aftermath of an uprising, a time where people name their pain, life has settled back down to the familiar, to a time where Black bodies are endangered, Black life is criminalized, and Black spaces exist only on the edges of both the city and our minds. I am not old enough to remember life before Brown v. Board, where Black and white spaces were so clearly marked. I suspect, though, that it was not much different than it is now in places around Baltimore and places across America where the crime of breathing while Black is still punishable by death. My heart always skips a beat when a cop's car is behind me while I'm driving at night. And though my sons are not old enough to drive, I am already frightened, concerned, angry, frustrated as I think about the day when they will be stopped for the crime of driving while Black. There are days when being Black in America overwhelms me and makes me want to spend the day in bed, and times when being the Black mother of Black boys in Baltimore City makes me wish I had enough money to move them somewhere where I could keep them safe. Safe from them, the ones who see their lives as expendable and unnecessary, and safe from us, those who look at them without realizing that they are mirrors that simply reflect all of who they are supposed to be. I often think about slavery and how different life was when you could see the hand that held the chain that was attached to the ball that was tied to your ankle. We come from a people who experienced this daily and still chose to survive. Survival is our legacy. And since we survived the Middle Passage as involuntary passengers on a trip that sealed our fate, and we survived slavery, whips, and lashes by learning how to give way and stay small, and we survived the Civil War by claiming freedom at the hands of those who looked like our oppressors, and we survived Jim Crow by teaching our children the unwritten rules that were marked by our blood. And we survived Black mayors who moved from our communities, took a piece of our spirit, but left their humanity behind. We will survive this. And though there are times when we are like strangers in a foreign land, we look around and wonder how we got here. We take stock and realize how little we actually have. We wonder how long we will continue to suffer and die at the hands of both the oppressor and of the oppressed, but we survive anyway. There are days when I look at my son and my heart swells with pride as I think about all that they used to be and all that they can become. And then I stop and I catch my breath. I grab my chest and I clutch my pearls. I blink back tears and shake my head because I am the mother of two Black boys being raised in a post-racial world where my cries for justice for Freddie Gray and for Tyrone West and for Sandra Bland and for Tamir Rice still get swallowed up and suppressed. There are nights when I stand in the doorway of their room, not to wake them up for the revolution, but to simply remind myself that just for a moment they are still safe and they are still here. All I want is what every other mother wants around the city. The simple comfort of knowing that my sons' lives matter to those that look like them and those who don't, and that my work to pour love, light, and truth into them will not be in vain. And with this very simple truth, as my songs of peace get lost in my never-ending cries for justice, I know we will survive. We will rebuild. We will move on. Survival is our legacy, and surviving every day in this system is our goal.
It's very heartfelt and powerful.
Thank you.
It really is. I think when you write that, you write it for so many people.
I think it resonates with people. I have used this poem a lot during the month of February when I was out doing my Race Brave tour and talking about what it means to be a survivor and talking about teaching our children this survival instinct that is something that is embedded within you. If we as a people have survived all that we have survived in this country, surely we can survive what's happening now. Surely we can get to the other side. Surely we can be better today than we were yesterday. Surely we can expect more from people that have been chosen and selected to serve us. And that means serving us through in political means, serving us in being a police officer, serving us in terms of working for the community. These are public servants. And part of that, there's a responsibility to work hand in hand with the community. And that's what song speaks to.
The fact that you were driven to put this together, given where we are now, I mean, and it really does fit, because this is a very special time. I was thinking about that, you know, here on the show, we are going to be producing daily pieces and have been for this month of April to think about Freddie Gray, to think about the social, political, and cultural consequences of what happened and why they happened and where we're going, and to produce conversations and short doc pieces for everybody here, because I think we really – we're at a very crucial moment, I think.
We are. We're at a turning point. And so the question is, how do we turn this corner to be better? I mean, I often challenge people around this question of what does it mean to be better, to say that we're not going to go back to what we used to do, to say that we're going to challenge everyone around us to be held to a higher standard. We are at a critical moment. And my biggest concern, Mark, is that we're going to pass this critical moment and we're not going to take advantage of it.
But in my optimistic way, I fluctuate a lot between optimism and pessimism in this world.
As we all do.
It's a swing back and forth, you know. But I think about how America fought and turned this corner and ended the enslavement of African people in this country.
We did.
Only to be confronted by the reinstitution of semi-slavery with segregation laws, yes, and how that was beaten back 100 years later.
Right. I mean, but it takes time. And what you're talking about.
And now but that opened the door to not just the opportunity for Dr. Kay Whitehead now to be Dr. K. Whitehead, PhD,
right?
But also meant that there are millions of people who are completely dispossessed in our prisons and in the places we are, and the racism is still deep in this country. And that's the corner we're turning now. We don't know what's going to – once we push this back, we have no idea what's going to be around the corner that faces us next.
But
each piece of this is a struggle against what has happened and for what we can build.
It's interesting because when you lay that out, I think people sometimes forget that we're not talking about thousands of years. I mean, this is hundreds of years. This history, when you really think about what it means to be free. I mean, slavery ended in, 1865. And so you have that period of Reconstruction for 10 years when we talk about that being the height of black life in this country, the establishment of black colleges, black senators. You know, you have a really large black middle class. And then you hit the nadir. Like, you know, with this, you know, legalized segregation, we hit a nadir in black life in terms of voting rights, in terms of social rights, in terms of economic privileges. It really fell down very low. And then you had this turn. So then on top of that, you added in Plessy. On top of that, you added in what was happening across the South in terms of, you know, the growth of the prison industry and what's happening in the schools. That was taking place. And then we can pick this conversation up and begin to dissect it more.
So, folks, the conversation will continue and only continue with your help. Stay with us. And now they got me rocking on the microphone. And then we're talking autographs and cheers and laughs, champagne, caviar, and bubble bath. Sucker MCs, DMC, 410-319-8888.
That's when I first got into rap. DMC is my cousin. That's how I got into rap as a young girl.
Your cousin?
Daryl McDaniel is my first cousin. So I was there from the ground up when they first broke it.
So the thing about this piece, don't be a sucker, become part of WEAA.
Yes. 410-319-8888. Don't be a sucker. Come a part of WEAA.
And show your support. You know you're listening to us right now at home, at your office, in your car. Take a minute. If you're doing your car, pull over and take a minute. Call 410-319-8888.
Pull over. Take a minute. But you can call. It will take 88.9 seconds to make your pledge, and you will be done. You can do this. You can be a part of the WE and WEAA.
So we are, while they're making this pledge of support, let us now go back to your book for a moment. Can we do that?
We can do that. We can do that.
And while people are making their pledges, let's have a lovely piece that you've written we haven't heard yet. There's so much in this book.
There's so much in this book. I'm going to read.
Where are you going to take us now?
And it's interesting because I'm doing a switch in energy from Race Brave to Pledge, Pledge to Race Brave. But just to bring it down a second, because one of the things that I look to do in the book is – I was marking what was happening throughout the year. And so that's that pledge I took to write something every day. So on the day when Jordan Davis was murdered in on 11/23/15, I wrote a piece for him called My Groove Echo. And it's called For Jordan Davis, Forever 17. We are not invisible simply because you refuse to see us. We will not stop fighting simply because you demand our obedience. We will not stop dancing simply because you refuse to hear our song. We will not give up simply because you refuse to believe that power concedes without a struggle. We are not going to forfeit our voices simply because you're tired of hearing our words. We will not stop shouting simply because you try to cut out our tongues. We will not stop coming simply because you hold up your palm. We will not continue to be what you're trying to create, an experiment gone wrong. You will not be able to will or wish us away simply because you refuse to recognize our humanity. We are little miracles, having conquered the art of survival. We have learned how to swallow our pain and then used it to spark our genius.
Mm.
So for each of the poems that I wrote for someone, for Jordan Davis, for Tamir, for Sandra Bland, for Freddie Gray, I mailed them to the families in the hope that they would know that there's
some... Have you heard back from any of them?
I have not heard back from any of them. But I just wanted them to know there's somebody somewhere who's
so
also
what did you
wanting
write?
To...
Do we have time to... How much time do we have? Let me see what we got here. Can you... Do we have time to... Is it long, the Sandra Bland piece?
No, it's not very long. I'll read that one very
quickly. Her sister was on this program. We had an incredible conversation with her sister. So.
Yes, it was great. It's called Sunday Morning Service for Sandra Bland. We say your name because we want you to know that you have not been erased. You're not just a memory. You're not just a fragment. You're not just a fragrant caught in our wind. We chant your name because we could not stop your arrest. We saw it but could not act, as throwing stones at a computer never changes anything. Mm. We whisper your name over and over again because we will still strive to find the normal, to give voice to our pain, to reclaim what we love, and to remember who you are. We whisper it over and over again because there is a sore, festering, raw, infested real called racism that has always been there, covered up for years by enslavement, by Reconstruction, by the Nadir, covered up for years by segregation, by voting rights, by amendments, uncovered finally by the stench that is post-racial. We sing your name because we have come to the place where we must be held accountable. We didn't want you to be just a hashtag, a name thrown around by politicians who want our vote but not our voices, but we let it happen because we couldn't stop it. We will stand on your name, Sandra, because we have learned how to sit quietly and meditatively at the feet of your memory. We will not set up a tent there, though, and remain, but there's no time to rest, not just yet.
Mm. Every time that's very powerful. It strikes me as very deeply because I think of, when I think of Sandra Bland, I think of my oldest daughters.
Really? Now, why is that?
They can be Sandra Bland.
Yeah. Okay, I'm thinking in terms of, is it their personality?
Standing up for themselves. And, you know, knowing that they would go, what do you mean, put out my cigarette? Just give me the ticket. That it could be any one of them who ends up not even thinking about suicide or death and then all of a sudden is found dead in their cell.
Yeah, but that's the before world. In this afterworld, it's not the same thing. I know that there was a time when cops would pull me over, and I would get confrontation. I want to know, what have I done? I was just driving. And I would be very confrontational. I was pulled over by a cop a week ago, and my whole demeanor was different. I was on my block. I wanted to get home. I didn't want to die in my car, even though I'm not sure if that would happen. That's what I was thinking about. So my whole demeanor changed. I was very, very polite, very respectful. I just wanted to get home safely.
Dr. K. Whitehead, amazing books. We're now going to talk to you about how you can get this amazing book and why you support your public radio, WEAA. We'll be right back.